Shali Srufavayit, the story of the kina, of the book burning that took place in Paris. Again, this story is actually found, the story of the kina itself is very much found down at the bottom. But we'll just give a little bit of the background. The year 12, let's see what do we got. In the year 1240, there was a fellow by the name, before that, there was someone named Louis the Ninth. Louis the Ninth is otherwise known as St. Louis. St. Louis, the city St. Louis, is named after this Louis.
He was a pope or he was a king?
He at that time was the pope. Oh, sorry, he was a king. Sorry, he was a king at that time, the French king. And he was very frum. Not the frum we would visit it, envision, but he himself was very frum in the Christian faith. And he made attempts at starting crusades. Right, so last week we spoke all about the crusades, talking about the Sugi of Miite and Rosh Hashanah. So he also tried, the aftermath of the crusades also tried, but he was remarkably unsuccessful in his attempts, at military conquest. So he kind of reverted back to inside to show off his frumkeit in other very strange ways. So one of the ways that he wanted to was to see how many Jews they could possibly convert, and they were able to convert a few. Some are Jews that converted to Catholicism, and as one could actually think about it, it makes a lot of sense. Those people that actually did convert, so they are the ones that constantly have a chip on their shoulder, right? They're the ones that are constantly. They got to prove themselves. They got to show off a little bit. So there's one of these apostates whose name was Nicholas Donin. So A, he caused some other problems. It's described here in this section. Yeah, it's described here that this fellow Nicholas Donin, he was the one who directed various pogroms or forced conversions of various cities. Here in this paragraph here, it says there are five. He went to the Jews of the city of Anjou and Poitiers. 500 Jews from those cities surrendered for the threat of death and were baptized, while the majority of the Jews, 3,000 martyrs in all, chose to meet their death while sanctifying God's name. Okay, so Nicholas Donin, while he figures he has some power in his hand and therefore he'll be able to, come on, these Jews won't stand up to the task, they won't stand up to their faith. I didn't stand up to my faith, so they wouldn't either. And meanwhile, he found himself to be wrong. So he's back to the drawing boards for Nicholas Donin. So Nicholas Donin said, you know what, I have a different idea. This is what we're going to do. What is the reason why the Jews are so strong in their faith? The reason why the Jews have been keeping their faith so long is because of their learning, is because of the Gemara. Now, not the Bible. The Bible is something that we share with them. But the Talmud is what keeps them going.
Rabbi Gross, was Nicholas Donin a learner? I mean, was he a Talmud Chacham?
I don't know much about him. All I know about Nicholas Donin is really what's found here in this paragraph. He sounds like he was just
a regular Yid,
I don't know what he was before. Apostate who was especially vicious in his hatred for his former co-religionists and caused forced baptisms of the Jews of Anjou and Poitiers. Yeah, I don't know much about him.
Okay.
So Nicholas Donin suggested that maybe it's the Talmud, and the Talmud also contains within it anti-Christian teachings. That's why all these Jews, for some weird reason, all happen to be anti-Christian, because it's the Talmud. So he gathered all the Talmuds and brought them together and sent them to the Vatican, and Pope Gregory the Ninth agreed. Surprise, surprise. And the Pope issued orders to seize all of the Talmuds, and the Frenchmen, of course, were eager to agree. And on March 3rd, 1940, while they were in their shuls, the people came in, the soldiers came in and took all of the Talmuds. And on June 12th, there was a public debate held. The public debate was held led by Rav Yechiel ben Yosef, who's known as Rav Yechiel miParis. He's one of the Bali Tosfos. It states incorrectly here, in this story here, that Rav Yechiel was the father of the Rush. It's not true. The Rush, Rabbeinu Asher, who maybe we'll get to a little bit tonight, Rabbeinu Asher's father's name was Yechiel, but he was not Rav Yechiel miParis. Okay? So, A couple others were also part of this disputation, and although they seemed to perform pretty well, of course, they lost. They lost disputation, and the Pope yelled, said that they all, got to burn all of the Talmuds. And in the year 1242, on the Friday of Erev Parshas Chukas, so the Friday of Parshas Chukas, all of the 24 wagon loads or 30 wagon loads, there's different amounts that are given, but the many wagon loads of Sfarim, or not really Sfarim, but scrolls, were gathered together and were burnt in a square in Paris. Now we happen to know where this square is. The square is the park that is located behind the Louvre. So if you ever go to Paris, it looks all beautiful and pretty, and etc. So keep in mind, as in Paris, as in many places throughout Europe, the ground has been both literally and figuratively soaked with Jewish blood. So the Talmud was burnt, and the Rav Soloveitchik, when he would recite this kina, would always point out that the Talmud being burnt then is not like the Talmud, like us being burnt, meaning if soldiers would come in, take all of these Sfarim off the shelves and would burn them, so it would obviously be a disgraceful act of anti-Semitism, but it would not be a national disaster. How many people actually use the books on the shelf? And even if they would take all the books from the base medrash over there, right, it still would not be considered a national disaster. But in those days, it was a national disaster. Why was it a national disaster?
Because
that was it.
Yeah.
There was no Torah. Without the Talmud, without those scrolls, there was the entire Torah Shebal Peh was going to be lost. And in fact, the Maharam, I think it's quoted also here, but I found the tshuva today that didn't make the source sheet. Maharam himself, a couple of years after this occasion, we'll talk about the Maharam in a minute, Maharam writes in a tshuva a responsa about a topic that I would love to go into this in more depth, but I can't because I don't have any svarim. So all my books were taken and they were burnt, and unfortunately I'm limited to what I can tell you right now. Okay, so that was what happened there. The legend has it was that the burning was actually seen by the Maharam, right? Rav Meir M. Rutenberg. Rav Meir M. Rutenberg saw this. He was a young man, I think in his young twenties, 22, we figure out, at the time when he saw this. And he was a Talmud, he was a student of Yechiel Paris. And Maharam Rutenberg left. He then left Germany. He left France and went to Germany. Last week talked about all the Jews leaving Germany and going to France. So now Rutenberg, who was known as the last of the Bali Tosafos, he was the last of the Tosafos at this point in the year 1242 or 1243. Soon after this event, leaves France, takes everybody with him. That's pretty much the end of French Jewry for a time, at least central French Jewry. And then the Jewish community of Ashkenaz reestablishes itself back in Germany, at least for a short amount of time, as we'll see. And then after that amount of time, the Jewish community mostly moves east at that point into Poland, into Russia, and Lithuania, and Northern Europe, and all of those places that were that start, a little bit more recognition for us. Okay, so that is the story. That is the story of the kina. We won't go through the kina itself. You look at the kina itself. I mean, it's as opposed to earlier kinos, much like last week, as opposed to many other kinos, where it's poetry and there are these pentameters and all these different and rhymes and word games and alphabetical, all those different things. This kina has none of that. This kina is just pure sorrow. It's just yelling. It's just HaKadosh Baruch Hu, how can you do this to us? How do you expect us to do mitzvahs if you're not going to give us the Torah to learn how to do them from? Okay, so that's the story of the kina itself. Now, you may have caught on to something. The other dates I told you, right? The date of the collection of the Talmud and the date of the debate, right? What is the date that this was burnt? What was the date of the actual burning of the Talmud? No. So I mentioned it briefly. It's described as taking place on Erev Shabbos Parshas Chukas. Okay, Erev Shabbos Parshas Chukas. So that's a little bit of a strange way of commemorating the day. Right? So let's take a look. Now let's go to the source sheet. quote from the Mugging of Rum in Siman Tav Kuf Pei. Now, in a way, this is also a continuation of last week. Last week, he spoke about extra days of mourning, right? That was really what part of what last week's year was about. But besides Tisha B'Av, perhaps there are other days over the course of the year that were established as days of fast, as days of mourning. So the Mugging, so Shulchan Aruch quotes a bunch of those days, and the Mugging of Rum picks up on a bunch of those days and adds in a few more of his own. And if you look, I guess about, I don't understand, it's Rashi's script. I'll read it to you. But six lines from the bottom, the Mugin of Ram says like this, Kosav Hatanya. The Mugin of Ram, by the way, is a commentary on the side of the Shulchan Aruch. I don't see any Shulchan Aruchs in here. When you look at the Shulchan Aruch is right in the middle. It's the commentaries that line the side of it. In Orach Chaim, in this section, the Mugin of Ram is on one side, and the Turi Zav is on the other side. So we're going to learn a Mugin of Ram now. The Mugin of Ram writes, Kosav Hatanya, by those two dots, six lines from the bottom. By Yom Hashishi Parshas Chukas, on Friday of the week of Chukas, Nagu Yechidim Lehisanus. There were Yechidim. There were specific people who would fast. Sheba Oso Hayom Nistrufu Chaf Kronos Meleim Svarim Bitzarfas. So on that day they burnt 20 wagons that were filled of Svarim in France. Vilo Kavu Oso Bimei Hachodesh. So now the Mugin of Ram says, well, why weren't they koveya it based on the date? Right? We don't celebrate Tisha B'Av the Friday of Av, we celebrate the 9th of Av. Right? We celebrate, even though Pesach, I think, happened on Shabbos, I think we have a tradition, right? We celebrate Pesach on the 15th of Nisan, not on the Shabbos of Nisan. So why all of a sudden here are we invoking a specific Parsha, a specific day of the week and a Parsha? That's what he wants to know. So he says, why? Mishnei Shemitoch She'elas Chalom was by way of asking in a dream. Wow. By way of asking in a dream, Nodea Lehem She'yom HaParsha Gorim Gezeiras HaTorah. That they found out that it was the day of the Parsha. It was that week, it was actually specifically having to do with that Parsha that caused the Gezeiras HaTorah. What in the world is that talking about? So, Zos Chukas HaTorah Metargminon Da Gezeiras Oraisa. Because the translation of the first, what is the first couple words of Parshas Chukas? Well, not really the first couple words. Parshas Chukas starts out by Devar Hashem L'Shavi Aron Leimor, Zos Chukas HaTorah, Asher Tziva Hashem Leimor. Right? These are the Chokim of the Torah. So how does the Torgamon, who is the Torgamon? Who is the Torgamon of the Torah? He's referring to Unklus. Right, if you look at Unklus translates those Chukas HaTorah, da Gezeiras Oraisa. This is a Gezeira, this is the dictate of the Torah. Okay, what has that done for us? By the way, Mugin of Ram then goes on and shows you a few other things that happened that day. He also says, Vegam Mishnas Tav Ches. In the year Tav Ches, that would be the year of the Crusades, that's what we talked about last week. Marbu Shnei, Nechrevu Shnei Kehilos Gedolos, Bo'osayim, Koshikos Veslichos, Shechavar Baal Hasifsei Hashach. I'm sorry. No, on that day. On that day, two kehilos were destroyed in the slicha that was written by the Shach. So remember that last week we talked about the Shach? What was the Shach? What period did the Shach live through? Of Shapsai Hakohen Rappaport? The Gezeros of Tach, the Tat, right? The Gamishnas Tach, the Chamulitsky Uprising, 1648-1649. Okay? So that also happened today. Okay, so that also happened on that day, Erev Shabbos Parshas Chukas. What in the world is he talking about, though? That the Sheila Skala? What's going on? So there's a Sefer Shivlei Haleket. The Sefer Shivlei Haleket. Oh, I looked up 20 minutes ago. Who wrote the Shivlei Haleket? I forget right now who wrote the Shivlei Haleket. But the Shivlei Haleket, also sometimes known as the Tanya, the original Tanya, not the Tanya the Lubavitcher.
But there was the original Tanya?
There's a Tanya that was written by Rishon. Shivlei Haleket is the...
Oh, I see. What year was that written?
an abridged version of the Shivli Leket is called the Tanya. It was written must be 1400s something.
Was there some reason that Shneur Zalman of Lodi named his Tanya the Tanya?
The reason his sefer is called the Tanya is because it starts out with the first word of the book is Tanya. It's a brisa. Tanya means a brisa, teaching. Right? So Tanya, the first brisa that's in the Sefer Tanya, is the story of the child that's born with Kol Torah Kula, and then they get a hit before they're born, or the child that learns all of Torah in the mother's womb, and then gets a snack, and then comes out. Right? That's the first. I'm sorry. That's not.
That's not Tanya.
What? I'm sorry. Tanya is. Is man inherently good or is man inherently bad? That's how Tanya starts out. I forgot the price of
the Shama Elokit.
Yeah, that's what Tanya's about. It starts out with his man inherited as good man. So it starts with the word Tanya, which is a brisa from Sefes Nida.
So it has nothing to do with the other.
Nothing to do with each other. They just need their books the same thing. So he writes like this. Vinesa, so that's the second source I put on the page here. Vinesa fa Torah Elokeinu bishnas chamesha salafim v'dalash on it. So the burning of the Torah took place in the year 5004. Does that make sense? I guess. It could be. Okay. Lebrias olam biyom shishi parshas v'zosa chukas haTorah. Right, Esther v'arba. Here he says 24. Right, the Magen Avraham said 20. Here he's saying 24. Karkanos meleim sifrei halimud v'halachim v'agodos nisruim v'tzarfas. 24 wagon loads were burnt in France. Kasher shamanu. What does that say? Kasher. I can't read that. Something nishmoa ozen. V'gam kein harabanim shahayu sham shamanu. Sha'asu she'ela schalom. So we heard from the rabbis that were there that they did a she'ela schalom. What's a she'ela schalom? It means that they take, I don't know how it works, but you take like a book and you chumash and you put it under your pillow at night, and based on creases or where it turns or where it's open to or something like that, you can find out the answer to your question.
Well, that's like writing into the igris.
Right. None of these types of things. So they did a she'ela schalom. And it came up to this word. I can't read this. He me'es habore. If this difficult thing that happened to them, was it me'es habore? Was it from Hashem? Or was it just stam? Was it happenstance?
Ve'hishivu lahem. That was by happenstance, though.
Nothing happens by absence. I know. I'll talk about that in a minute. But they say, is this based on something? Or based on something very significant? And then, Shiva Lehem, Fida, something Oraisa. I can't read that. Oh, Zos Gezeras Oraisa. Right, this is a Gezerah of the Oraisa. Upershu Bayom Vav, Zos Ulchasa Torah, Hiha Gezerah. Ume Oso Hayom Ve'ela, that day is the Gezerah, meaning the sixth day of the week, that's the Gezerah. Ume Oso Hayom Ve'ela, Kavu Hayudim Alein Lisanos Bo, Bechol Shana Veshana, Vyom Shishi Shaparsha Zos Ulchasa Torah, Vilu Kavu Limeachod, Shay didn't establish based on the month, Te Afra Alein Ula Kapara, in order for it to be a Kapara, Ka'ola Al Mukta Va'arava Livne Yehuda, I can't read all these words, Kavilcha Kreva Kilchas. It's in the fact that we're going to fast on those days is going to be a kapara. Now, what's the Shivli Halakhah leaving out? A kapara for what? Right, what's he saying? What's he giving a kapara for?
Why does everything have to be in the port? Why couldn't it be that Hashem wanted everybody to move to Poland? How am I going to get the Jews to move to Poland?
Right.
So the truth is,
since you're raising that question, and we have a little informal group, we can take a little step out and go to the back page. Go to the back of the page. Okay. I put down a Rambam, the second source from the top. You see, there's something there. It says Gimel. So that is a Gimel. That's a Rambam from Hilchos Tanis. Perek Aleph Halacha Gimel. Very important Rambam. The Rambam there is talking about the obligation to pray. Sorry, it's a little bit small. The Rambam is talking about the obligation to pray. And the Rambam writes about, right, he says, when something bad, what's the obligation to pray? The Rambam says, when something bad happens to you, when you're in a difficult situation, you're obligated to pray. And then the Rambam then says, about im lo yizaku v'lo yariyu, right, if you don't cry out, call out, and you don't cry, el yomu davar zemi minaga olam, and you just say that such a thing happened, it's happenstance. Right, Iralanu Vitsarazu Nikra Nikris, and this bad thing that's happened to us is Nikris, is happenstance. Harezu Derech achzorios, that is cruelty. They're achzorios, v'goremus lohem li'davik ma'isim ha'raim. That's going to cause them to stick to their bad things. It's going to cause other bad things to happen, etc., etc.
It's also heretical, isn't it?
It's heretical, what?
If people say, oh, it's just circumstance, it's just happenstance.
Okay. Okay, fine. So, very good. So the Rambam says, what's the Rambam saying? The Rambam is saying that when something bad happens, that you are obligated to look for the reason behind it. Now, what's important to point out, I don't have to go through the whole shiur, I once gave a shiur on this, in Phoenix, actually, entitled Blaming the Victim. That whenever bad things happen, right, like I remember what drove me to this was Hurricane Katrina. As soon as Hurricane Katrina happened, so if you, I think you can actually find that on the Wikipedia page under causes of Katrina. So, you know, the first couple are the dam broke and the gullies, you know, the thing broke and the pumps broke and that. And Pastor so and so said it's because they're all a bunch of whatever. And the other one says it's because of Mardi Gras. The other one says it's because of this. The other one says it's because of that.
Really?
Right? So is that okay? You can find it. Go find it online. So is that an appropriate statement to make? Oh, well, such a thing happened to them because they blah, 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 blah. Or the reason the Jews were thrown out of Gaza is because blah, 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 blah.
The hurricane.
Great Rabbanim said in the Holocaust, he said, because we committed many errors.
Oh.
So this.
Or the Holocaust happened because we committed many errors. Is that appropriate or is that not appropriate? So you want to say, well, great Rabbi said.
Yes. So, I mean, you know.
Trump card.
That's right, because we're obligated to believe. You know what a Talmud Chacham says.
Okay, okay, but to an extent, that's correct. But if you look carefully at what
maybe
they said,
reason. Maybe Hashem wanted to build Eretz Israel.
Very good. So I believe the way to approach this is the Rambam is not saying that we will, that when something bad happens, I'm obligated to predict and say precisely why it happened. I don't think that's what the Rambam is saying. The Rambam is saying is that if something bad happens to us, I am obligated to figure out what I did wrong and how I could personally improve. Right? And then I remember once listening to a shiur from Rav Meir Tursky, who pointed out, he said, and what happens if you're wrong? If I say I got a strep throat because I talked during davening. And it's not because I talked during davening, rather it's because I wasn't so careful about my kashrus. Right? But meanwhile, as a result of my strep throat, I stopped talking during davening. So, were you wrong? So you weren't wrong. You improved yourself. So, you're right. So too here. That's what the Rambam is saying. That when something bad happens, you're obligated to look deep into yourself and see how I can improve. So, if somebody... So there's two categories of people that gave reasons for the Holocaust. And there's only people who don't give any reasons for the Holocaust. Say, how can we possibly give a reason? I think that's also against this Rambam. There's two categories of people that gave reasons for the Holocaust. They're those that said that the reason the Holocaust happened is because we didn't do enough X. Then there are also those that say the reason the Holocaust happened is because they didn't do enough X. Right? There's a big difference.
Yes.
There's a big difference. If you say they didn't do enough X, I can show you a bunch of Gemaras that they're going against. Say, because we didn't do enough right, and therefore I'm going to use that to improve ourselves. So I think that's appropriate to the Rambam's talk. Okay? So too here. So a terrible thing happened. They had this tiny chalom. It's a gezeira, something terrible. It's as a result of something. What could it possibly be that caused this? And the truth is, you didn't have to look too far back to see a pretty obvious correlation. We're not going to have enough time. We're running out of time. But the Rav Hillel of Verona lived a little bit after that period. And Rav Hillel of Verona wrote a... Rav Hillel of Verona was one of the, I think, students of Rabbeinu Yonah. Yeah, I think. And he spells out here in a story, this is a pretty long piece, but he spells out here in the story that if you look back about, about 12 years, or 10 years, you'll see, actually 9 years, you'll see an interesting correlation. Let's go back a little bit in time. The year 1204, somebody very important passes away. Who is that?
Rashi.
The Rambam. The Rambam. The Rambam passed away. Rashi passed away before that. Rashi was alive, if you remember last week. Rashi was alive in the year 1096. So I don't think he made it to the year 1204. That would be quite a feat. Not only was he alive in the year 1096, he was already back tucked away in he was tucked away in France by the time 1096 came around. But the year 1204, Maimonides passes away. The year 12, so the Rambam wrote some very interesting things over the course of his life. He wrote what we just quoted from. The Rambam also wrote many works that at that time, and really until this day, are disputed about whether they are true. He's right. He was an extremely rationalistic person, and therefore reinterpreted many texts and said everything has to, should be logical and rational, and that led him to have a few enemies. And if you think about things in those days, first of all, it's 30 years after he passed away. So nowadays, people argue on people that passed away 30 years ago. I mean, that's not so crazy. People have disputes with Avraham Cutler, who lived 50 years ago. So he lived only 30 years ago. Not only did he live 30 years ago, the people that had the disputes with the Rambam never met him. They were living in Spain. They were living in Provence. They were living in France. They were living in Germany, etc. So in France, Rav Shlomo Min Hahar, and actually in France, Provence. Provence is the space between France and Spain. It's a narrow gap there where a lot of very important Jews lived. Raifid, Balamor, a lot of people live there. And Shlomo Min Hahar attacks the Rambam and makes a ban. He asks other rabbis to join along with him. On the whole, most rabbis did not join with him, but he did get the ban to be signed by two other people. One of them's name is Rabbeinu David Ben Shaul, who I never heard of, and the other one's name was Rabbeinu Yonah, who maybe we have heard of. Rabbeinu Yonah signed the ban against learning the works of the Rambam.
So they blame the Rambam.
Whoa!
They blame his wisdom.
Hold on a second! No!
Work.
That was the year 1232. In 1232, a ban was signed against the Rambam. From between 1232 and 1233, a big fight broke out between the pro-Rambamites and the anti-Rambamites, concluding that happened in 1233, correct. In 1233, that concluded in some people who were not very sophisticated reporting to the church that this fellow Maimonides contained many anti-Christian ideas in his work. And in the year 1233, the Rambam's manuscripts were burnt in the streets of Paris.
So Mito's connected.
Things continue on for 9 years, and the year 12, as we said before, in the year 1242, this entire business happened in the year 1242. The burning took place just 9 years following. There is, in the middle of this Chemdas Genuza, it makes a mention of 40 days later, the Rambam's after the Rambam was burnt. That's not true. That's actually quoted here. There's actually three pretty significant inaccuracies here. One of them is this. It says that it was burnt in the year 1242. They once again burnt the books of the Rambam. That's not true. It's based on 40 days later is like a figure of speech. Like a short time later, such a thing happened. But the claim, and I think in the year 12, so when they asked, when they turned in the She'elos Chalom and said, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the same thing that happened now happened 9 years earlier. Is it because of that thing? Is it something that was established and they got back Zog Gezer O'Reisa? I don't know. It's one thing saying that Katrina happened because of Mardi Gras. It's another thing happened to say that there's a correlation, a clear correlation between these two. And in fact, the Rav Hillel of Verona in this piece here, he asks, this is like a historical document here, he asks, and lest you say that because of the honor due to the Rambam, right? They said because of the honor, even those people that disagreed with the Rambam, they said because of the honor due to the Rambam, this is what happened. He says, unless you say that it's because of lack of honor to one person, all of Torah should be lost. Because remember, in those days, that's what they thought. They thought all of Torah should be lost. Because of disgrace to one person, all of Torah should be lost. He says, you don't have to look any further than the story of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. Where because of the dispute to the honor of one person, the entire Beis HaMikdash was lost. So that's the story. That's the story leading up. The story of the aftermath of the story continues on in two ways. Number one, there was a... By the way, would the Rambam have cared that there was such dispute about his work? Because if you turn to the back of the page, there's English right in the middle that could put a piece... I have the Rambam's Guide to Perplexed as well. I just didn't have it on me when I made these copies. But here's a very important quote from the Rambam. The Maimonides writes in his introduction to the Mor Nevuchim, which is the disputed book. He writes, "When I have a difficult subject before me, when I find the road narrow, and I can see no other way of teaching a well-established truth except by pleasing one intelligent man and displeasing 10,000 fools, I prefer to address myself to the one man and to take no notice whatever of the condemnation of the multitude. I prefer to extricate that intelligent man from his embarrassment and show him the cause of his perplexity so that he may attain perfection and be at peace." So the Rambam's stand, the Rambam took a very clear stand. The Rambam said, you know what, so it might lead some people, and that was the problem. The problem was there's philosophy, and some people off the derech, people aren't going to know, and not going to understand, they're not going to distinguish, and they're going to be studying all this, and they're not going to learn any Torah. All of those complaints, the Rambam said, tough. If it's emes, it's emes, and it's got to be true, it's got to be taught. So this is a dispute that continues out of Yom HaZeh. I mean, we hear this nowadays in the last 15 years. I could probably cite you 15 examples about of this dispute manifesting itself, about whether things should be included or whether or not. And we know about certain books that have been banned over the last couple of years. We know about Rabbi J.J. Shackler has a very important article where he talks about historical truths, that there are various works that have been changed or altered to, you know, leave out little inconvenient portions that that people don't want to take the time to explain or admit to. It's important. Okay. So then, how was this resolved? So this didn't necessarily end the fighting between the Rambam camp and the anti-Rambam camp. Right? They were still at odds with each other. So I just put here a little copy of the book of the Ramban. The Ramban wrote a very important... probably going to have to stop here. The Ramban, Nachmanides, who lived a little bit later. The Ramban lived from 1194 to 1270. So think about it. He was coming into his own... He was coming into his own as a rabbi when this happened, right? 1232 was the book burning. That means that the Ramban was 38 years old at the time when this happened. So Ramban, he was a rav in Barcelona. And he acted as the conciliator between these two sides. And just as an example of how the Ramban worked, so I put on the top here a copy of the Ramban's introduction to his Milchemes Hashem. The Milchemes Hashem is a work on the Rif. If it looks in the back of the Gemara, so there's the Rif, Rabbeinu Alfasi, took all the halachos of the Gemara and made up his own sefer where he quotes the halachos. So the Rif had some things that were questionable. Obviously, anybody who writes something, the sign of it being something special and something important is if people comment and argue on it. And the Baal Amor, who lived in Provence, the same place where Rabbeinu Yonah, apparently the big hotheads in Provence, so the Baal Hamor took him on. The Baal Hamor disputed him and attempted to rip him apart, and to the point of calling names, etc. That was a style of those Rishonim there. So the Ramban wrote the Sefer Milchamos Hashem. What was the Sefer Milchamos Hashem? It was a response to the Baal Hamor's problems with the Rif. And why did he write? He writes here in the introduction. This is what I put. He said, "And why did I write this sefer?" asks the Ramban. Not because I think the Rif is right. Because I think the Baal Hamor was wrong in attacking the Rif in the way that he did. I mean, the Rif. Well, okay, I don't agree with him either, but it doesn't mean that he is indefensible. I'm going to defend him. Now, you have to sometimes, as you learn the sefer, you have to sometimes know what the Ramban really hold. I mean, what did he really hold? And what was he saying just to defend the Rif? So that's a scholarly question, not just a scholarly question. That's a Lundish question, a Torah learning question that you have to analyze when learning the Ramban. But we see the style of the Ramban. The Ramban did this. This isn't the only occasion where he did this. The Ramban did this very often, where he said that the Rambam used to fight with the Bahad. People used to fight with the Bahag. So the Ramban there as well stood in and said, "Look, I don't agree with the Bahag either, but it doesn't mean that he's wrong. wrong. It doesn't mean that he's off the wall. Let's defend him a little bit. So that's what he writes. That's what he writes here. Yeah. Okay, we don't have to come inside. We don't have to go inside. And the final topic that comes from here is what happened to the Jews. So the Jews left. What happened to the Maharam? So the Maharam left. Maharam left France and went to Germany. Do you know where the Maharam settled? You're thinking Rundenberg, right? No, he's from Rosenberg. He settled in Worms, I think. Pretty sure he settled in Worms. Maharam settled in Worms, settled in Germany, built up the area of Germany. His prize student work, he really had two prize students. His two prize students were the Rush, Rabbeinu Asher, and the Mordechai. Have you heard of the Mordechai and the Rush? They're both commentaries.
I've never heard of
Mordechai. Okay, the Rush, Rabbeinu Asher. Mordechai also wrote a similar type of thing in the back of the Gemara, where it's a, he didn't write in the back of the Gemara, he wrote on a piece of paper. But it's found in our back of the Gemara, where he quotes the halachos of the Torah, etc. The Mordechai died al Kiddush Hashem. That's why the Mordechai is known as HaKadosh. The Mordechai is very often, it's not always true, but when you hear somebody described as HaKadosh, so it usually means that the person died on Kiddush Hashem. So like Rav Elchanan Wasserman could be described, he's often not described this way either. He's usually described as Hashem Yikom Damam, may God avenge his blood. But it would be appropriate to refer to Rav Elchanan Wasserman as Rav Elchanan Wasserman HaKadosh, right, the Holy One. Okay, so the Maharam left France, moved to Germany, set up his yeshiva there, had two main students, the Mordechai and the Rush, who he saw as the future of Ashkenazic Jewry. And the Maharam's life, in a way, ended in tragedy, because the Maharam was taken captive. I think the last 14 years of his life, he spent in captivity. So the story of things were the Emperor Rudolf in Germany was making things very difficult for the Jews. So the Jews all decided, they said, the heck with this, we're leaving Germany. So Emperor Rudolf said, well, hold on a second, I don't want you all to leave, because you're not going to be able to make me any money if you leave. So I hereby declare that all of your property belongs to the king, and all of you are my slaves. So the Maharam Rundenberg said, whoa, I'm out of here. So the Maharam Rundenberg left. He tries running away and gets caught at the border by none other than an apostate Jew. And he gets taken captive and he's put in prison. And Maharam never was taken out of prison. And there's a famous reason why, and then there's the real reason why. What I would assume would be the real reason why, because the famous reason why doesn't really seem to make that much sense. Anybody know the famous reason why? The famous reason why is because he said that the ransom for me is so high that it's inappropriate for you to ransom me.
Well, maybe I heard about him. Yeah, he didn't want them to ransom.
Right. And that reason, in fact, is quoted here in Sefer Yamshel Shlomo. Lived a couple of years. That's why it's so famous, because Yamshel Shlomo quotes it. He says that he wouldn't want himself to be poded, because he doesn't want to have himself be poded for more than his worth, because it's going to lead to other people being captured.
What's the real reason?
So the Yamshel Shlomo himself asks the question on it. He says the problem is that he gets Shulchan Aruch. Because in Shulchan Aruch it says, Shulchan Aruch wasn't written yet in the time of Maharam, but it's against the din of the Mishnah, that for a din mufla, not just in, there's a Gemara that seems to imply that as somebody who's a Talmud Kacha mufla, somebody who's the Gadol Hador, a big rabbi, so they could be redeemed for more than they're worth, even though it's going to cost the Jews a lot of money. Rather, what's probably the real reason? So there's a book called by Dr. Irving Agus, entitled Mayor of Rothenburg, where he goes into this whole story in detail, and he points out that what was really going on here. What was really going on was that Rudolf was imposing high taxes on all the Jews, and the Jews didn't want to pay, so the Jews said, we're leaving. And that's where the Maharam was captured. So the Jews turned around and said, okay, we will redeem the Maharam in Rothenburg. We'll redeem the Maharam. To which the emperor said, well, okay, you're welcome to redeem him, but I'm not just holding him captive for ransom. I will hold you captive because of all your back taxes. And the Jew said, whoa, hold on a second. We don't owe you any back taxes. That whole Dax's business is a Narishkeit. In fact, they actually had the Pope intercede on the Maharam Gutenberg's behalf. I read that today. They had the Pope intercede on the Maharam Gutenberg's behalf, and Emperor Rudolf said, no, I'm not letting him go, because I have a right to receive, to get taxes from you. So it wasn't that the Jews... It wasn't that the Jews didn't want to pay the high ransom. The Jews didn't want to pay that exorbitant amount of taxes. I'm not even sure they could pay the exorbitant amount of taxes. Right. It was just an impossibility to take the Maharam Gutenberg out under those circumstances. So, by the way, the Maharam Gutenberg was kept captive not only while he was alive, but even after he was dead for another 10, 12 years.
They wouldn't let his body.
They wouldn't even let his body be released until one Gvir came along and said, I'll pay for his body. So that was a good compromise, because the Emperor Rudolf said, fine, you're paying for his body, you're not attacked, you know, whatever. But but the Jewish community as a whole is responsible for taxes. So the entire Jewish community as a whole is going to give me money, it's going to be for taxes, it's not going to be for being the Aram Rutenberg. So for that reason, they did not. That's probably the real reason they did not redeem the Maharam Gutenberg. By the way, this story continues out of Yom Hazeh. I don't remember this. This was really before I was born. But in the year Tafshin Lamed, right? So now we're in the year Tafshin Ayin. So Tafshin Lamed was 40 years ago. Yeah. So before my time, the Rav Hutner. Was on there were a couple of jets that were hijacked, and on one of those jets was Rav Yitzchak Kuttner. Do you remember this? The story goes that Rav Yitzchak Kuttner was taken captive, and but of course they didn't tell the hijackers. They couldn't tell the hijackers. Then we caught the big
one. Who hijacked
one.
The plane?
The PLO or whatever. Okay. The Arabs.
Okay.
Arabs hijacked the plane and landed them in Jordan. So the question at that time was raised. They said, we have enough money to redeem that one captive. The Rav Hutner at that time was the Rosh Yeshiva Chaim Berlin. The Chaim Berlin Gvirim got together and said, could we redeem the captive? They didn't know what to do. So they went to Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky.
Okay.
And Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky Paskin told them that you can't do it. So this little article here, you can't. So why not? So this article is taken from Rav Shachtek Sefer. He quotes this idea, and he uses it to prove his point about Eretz Yisrael b'zman hazeh. He says that yes, it is true that you could redeem a captive if they're being asked for a lot of money. But Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky said that's only during peacetime. But during a wartime, all these rules go out the window. It was the year, this wasn't necessarily in the middle of a war, it was the year 1970, it was between 67 and 70, it wasn't the middle of a war, so that's where Shachter says, the entire history of Israel since 1948 has been in a constant state of war. And there's no way to argue that. It is. And all the rules of war exist. And that's it. This article is where he talks about giving land back, and all those different things. But he builds up the premise, or Shachter builds up the premise, it's all based on the idea that Eretz Yisrael is still in a state of war. And for that reason, Rav Hutner couldn't be redeemed. I've heard, just listening to a little other research on this, that Rav Yaakov is going to be the right decision. If Rav Hutner would have been redeemed, it would have like been a devastating blow to all the other captives that were
right.
there, etc. So
I guess they all got out.
Yeah. At the end, I don't know the end of the story, but yeah. So, anyways, although these shirim were probably not the most cheerful of topics, it was a pleasure teaching them and preparing them. And Mirza Hashem is still be out of a state of war real soon, and we could go on to teaching other things.